Hi, welcome to another episode of Cleaning Up the Mental Mess with Dr. Caroline Leaf. I'm Dominique, Dr. Leaf's daughter and podcast producer. Today's episode is taken from an interview Dr. Leaf did recently on the Cannibal Mindset podcast with Chad Sanchagrin. In this episode, Dr. Leaf discusses why labels like ADD and anxious person are so dangerous, especially when used on children, how to find freedom from labels, how to deal with problems like anxiety, how to help your children with anxiety, and so much more. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a 5-star review and keep sharing with friends and family. Also, for additional helpful resources and tools to help you take back control of your mental health, be sure to visit drleaf.com. Now, on to today's episode.
Welcome back to the Cannonball Mindset. And today is like, it's not Christmas yet, but it feels like it's Christmas morning for me because I'm sitting here and I'm getting ready to interview somebody that I think is, I referred to her today as the LeBron James of neuroscience. She is the best at what she does, bar none. She's written countless amount of books, just to name a few. Switch on your brain. Think, learn, succeed. Think and eat yourself smart. Along with I don't even know how many others. She's got an app. She's got an unbelievable podcast. She's everywhere. Dr. Caroline Leaf, thank you so much for giving me your time.
Oh, thank you. It's a great honor to be on your show. Thank you. Love what you do too.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I am if somebody would have told me 30 years ago that I would be one, have a podcast, would be surprising to me. But two, the idea that I'd be sitting down and having a conversation with a neuroscientist that is really just the best at what you do. And you're also a communication pathologist. I'm saying this is unreal to me because I don't have a college degree. And I graduated high school with a 1.6 grade point average. I didn't finish my first book until I was 25 years old, cover to cover, and really just had the wrong mindset. And I was labeled with all these things and all these, and most of the labels I gave were labels I put on myself. So to sit down and have a conversation with somebody with your intellect and your expertise, this is going to be an awesome conversation that I'm going to take a lot out of.
Well, that's really sweet of you. Thank you so much. And I love the name of your podcast, The Cannonball Mindset. That's really cool.
Everything is about mindset. And I only have you for a short amount of time, so I want to be really appreciative and respectful of your time, but I want to get right into it. And one of the things that I noticed, and I'm a father of twin 15-year-old daughters, is really that the power of your mindset in maybe how you're labeled now. I see labels happening a lot in schools. I see my kids coming home and it seems like every third friend they have, they say, well, Dad, she has ADHD or she has this, she has ADD. And these labels are flying out with our kids. What's your idea about labeling kids at such an early age and the impact it has going forward in the rest of their lives?
Well, first of all, I love the question. It's an incredibly important question. I hate the labels. That's the short answer. The long answer is that labels basically lock us in and they chain you and you kind of will live into the label if you don't actually understand what's going on. And we're in our culture today is one of label, diagnose, label, and prescribe. And it's been moving in this direction for the past 60 years. I practice for 25 years and I've been doing research for 30 years, clinical research. We've just finished a clinical trial just very recently, busy analyzing all of that at the moment. And I saw back in the 80s when I was doing my research and starting to practice that I was trained in an era where we looked at the individual as a unique case study and they had an individual narrative. And if a child was battling at school or a teenager was battling at school or battling with their emotions, we didn't just label them. There was not even a label for them. They were someone who needed help. So therefore they came into therapy and we would see if there was a learning issue, if there's a learning issue, there's inevitably an emotional issue. If there's an emotional issue, there's inevitably a learning issue. And what's going on? There's a story and every person's different. And it requires a team approach. So that is the training that I received. And what was very disturbing for me is that from about the mid-80s and really took off in the mid-90s, it shifted over to a much more what we call a reductionistic model, where the person's story, the sort of person, who they are, how they think, how they feel, how they choose, their mind was put to the side. And what became a major focus was the person's physical. So everything became about the brain. And this move really became very popular in the late 80s and early 90s when brain technology became very popular. And suddenly everything was all about, you know, your brain on this and your brain on that, and your brain made you do it. And the person was forgotten at the expense, you know, the brain became important at the expense of the person. And that is where it has really caused a massive problem, where this generation, your children, my children, they're growing up under the incorrect belief that if you're sad or if you're depressed or if you're anxious or if you're worried or if you are frustrated or if you're irritated or if you're dealing with stuff, that there's something wrong with you, that there is a brain disease, or that you have a neuropsychiatric brain disorder, or there's something wrong inside of you, or you're this imperfect, broken person, and that you need medication and that you're ill. And there's the first generation ever to grow up like that, the most medicated generation that we've ever had, a generation that is not being allowed to express their emotions, to feel their feelings and process them and reconceptualize them. And that's not only, I mean, this generation's growing up like that, but we also have from the older generation, so from 25 years, millennials and up, have also been sucked into this philosophy of, you know, mind doesn't really matter, your story doesn't really matter, and you are just simply a physical, biological automaton. And if you're feeling sad, there's something wrong with you, get a label, get a medication, squash it down. But we all know instinctively that that's not right, that that's wrong, that it's not helping. And we look 60 years later and we see the consequences of this labeling and diagnosing and prescribing and ignoring of the mind. And what we see is that people are actually dying 15 to 25 years younger, that we have a very frightening reversal of trends. Instead of people living longer, they're dying younger. And the age group most affected are your 25 to 64-year-olds. And so people are being struck down in the prime of their life. Children are losing their parents at a very young age. And they're tracking this back to lifestyle diseases. Basically, it's preventable from, people are dying younger from preventable lifestyle diseases. And what they're also seeing is that if people have a label, they're dying even earlier. So that trend of 15 to 25 years younger, those with a label, and you can add another 8 to 20 years on that. So someone who may have lived till 75 is now dying at 50. Someone who would have lived till 50 is now living living till maybe 25 or 30. And it's become pandemic in its proportion. It's across the developed world, and it's affecting pretty much every society. And this trend began it began in the 90s. They suspected something, started doing research, and now at this point in time, we recognize that there is a major problem. So at the same time as they started identifying the issue, at the same time as they started saying that it's all about the physical, it's all about the brain, and everything is the brain, and psychiatric drugs and antidepressants, and let's give you a label, and let's medicate you, and let's make everything about a medical model of illness. And at the same time as that, we introduced the modern American diet became very ubiquitous, and the processed food movement became very dominant. So we had two major factors that keep humans alive that started changing and transforming over that time. Almost immediately, the statistics showed up. Yeah. So now we're seeing 60 years later, we're seeing the results, and it's a disaster.
Yeah, I think this is really important, because the idea that, you know, I get this label, I'm diagnosed with a label, and it is it becomes all you hear now, or I think what is so prevalent is mental health, and people associate health with a drug, right? If you have a mental health problem, there's an immediate cure, and we're in this cure-all, fix-all society where, well, if I have to be fixed, that must mean I'm broken. And now I don't know how to, are we literally making people not understand how to actually cope with the stress, cope with the emotion? We're masking it with a Band-Aid. And then at some point the Band-Aid's not strong enough to hold it back anymore. Would that be a fair analogy?
Absolutely. You've summarized it totally correctly. When you ignore the person's mind, when you ignore their story and what they're going through, you're going to land up, and you just focus on the physical, you're going to land up with the kinds of problems that we are seeing, where it's people are it's literally like we all instinctively know that we are have a story and that we need to feel and that we need to have a better mindset and all that kind of stuff. But we are being told by the doctors and by the just general attitude, just the general philosophy in our society that you're not supposed to feel. But feeling is what begins the healing. You've got to look at those emotional and physical warning signals and recognize that they're telling you a story, that there's something going on. We've got to give ourselves and our children permission to embrace that depression, embrace that anxiety, embrace that those psychotic thoughts, embrace that irritation and frustration, the guilt, the shame. Because all of those are emotional warning signals that are telling you that something is going on in your life. And it's part of the human condition. It's not something weird. You're being a human. We've got to stop medicalizing misery and pathologizing suffering and allow people to process. If you don't get it out, it goes into your brain as a toxic, it's in your brain as this toxic thought, it goes into your body and your body's going to explode. You know, you can't suppress the irritation. You can't constantly suppress those traumas that you've been through, the bad experiences, and just keep yourself busy, 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 and hope it'll go away. It's not going to go away. You have to deal with stuff. And yeah, society now needs to shift back into allowing our children and ourselves to be human again.
Listen, I love that. And I'm a father. In theory, it sounds, and as logically, it even sounds so dead on. The challenge, I think, is, listen, I'm a father of twin 15-year-old daughters that are having emotional changes now, right? When it comes to boys, when it comes to their friends, when it comes to all these things that they're social media, they're bombarded, it seems like, more than I ever was. My, you know, when I was younger, I had tons of emotional stress, but my mother, who worked, was a single mother, she wasn't trying to fix me. She was, all right, you got to work it out. Not in a rejective type of way, but more of a, hey, listen, I'm busy trying to support three kids and you got to work these emotions out than normal. But now as a father, I see my kids in some sort of emotional distress. And the immediate reaction I have as a parent is to want to fix it, want to soften it, want to lessen it. But that's really the wrong approach in that sense. Is it be there and support them and let them work through it, or is it to immediately try to solve it for them so they don't feel that pain?
No, you see that, and I'm so glad you brought this up as well, because you have to let them feel the pain in order to know how to manage the pain. You have to be able to let them experience the stuff, otherwise they're never going to develop the coping skills. And the way that I explain it, I think, which makes it very easy to understand. If you think of a trapeze artist, they swinging through the air, but underneath they, and there's a lot of danger involved and there's a lot of direction and focus and skill. But underneath you've got the safety net. So if they do happen to fall, the safety net is there to catch them. And as a parent, we have to be a safety net. We can't be up there doing the swinging for them. They have to swing through life. They have to find the path. They have to do the work. They have to experience the failures and fall. And we all know that. And we can't, you know, we are in a society, helicopter parenting society, you know, make sure your kids get into college society, shape your kids society, get them into every lesson society. And, you know, you've got kids that are two twin girls that are 15. The 12 to 18 year old, from 12 through 18, is the most difficult part of the entire human life cycle. And it's at this stage that our children need everything at different stages. But in general, the overarching philosophy is to be there and tune into your children and be that safety net. The younger they are, the more guidance, obviously hands-on. But by the time you have a teenager, 12 to 18-year-old, they need to be listened to. And research shows this, and it's also instinctive, but parents don't always do this. But research shows that that the greatest desire that a teenager has is to be listened to. But most of the times they're not listened to, they're spoken at. And because they're trying to process the emotions and develop, you know, their linguistic skills are starting to develop to quite a high level that they can be quite, but they kind of jumbled. So they, the emotions and everything together, the brain's still developing. So very often it can come out as that they're being difficult. But that behavior is not necessarily that they're being difficult. It is representing something underneath. There's something going on. And it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, just like tolerate terrible behavior, but it doesn't mean that we should be punishing, pushing away, giving advice, telling them they're difficult, that kind of stuff. We need to be helping them to process life. We need to sit and listen. We need to say things like, this is a lot that you're going through, but we'll do this together. It's just a lot to handle. It's a lot to manage, but I'm here for you. And if you start getting to that mode of listening and tuning into your children and really, you know, finding out what they love to do and doing that with them, your kids will start talking and we can then be much more effective in parenting and much more effective in helping them as they fall, navigate that process. You wrap your child in cotton wool, you're actually preparing a child for failure for the rest of their life.
So profound in the sense of, again, the greatest thing you can do is be that safety net underneath, but they really do have to learn how to embrace their struggles, embrace that. And it sounds, maybe that's the wrong messaging, but embrace the fact that you're going to have these struggles and you have to build, is it building a resilient emotional fortitude? Like, so, hey, I know how to cope with this. I've been hit before. I've almost, like, you're building myelin in the brain. You're building this connection of emotional sheathing to be able to respond to it faster, better, quicker. Is that the same concept?
Yes and no. What happens is it's a lot more complicated than that. And this is the other thing. Brain science said the way it's presented to the average sort of in the media, it doesn't really give us the true picture. It's not sort of a matter of just growing networks, because the brain just does what we tell it to do. And your mind can override any network that you have built in your brain, because your mind is not your brain. So I think one of the principal elements that we need to always look at first is, what is the mind? What is the brain? And how do we change this whole thing? What is going on here? So if you start with absolute basics, at step number one, you need to understand that your mind is not your brain, that your brain is not your mind, that your mind is how you think and feel and choose. And your brain is physical substance that you're thinking and feeling and choosing moves through. So your mind is this energy of thinking, feeling, and choosing that literally uses the brain as a way of processing, storing, and expressing who you are and what you're thinking about. So as you're thinking and feeling and choosing, you're building all these networks into the brain. And these networks are thoughts, and these thoughts influence the entire body. And they become the roots of what you say and what you do. So that's the like basic principles. You're not your brain. You're growing your brain. You're changing your brain all the time. And these thoughts are very complicated. They're little protein structures that grow on top of the neurons in the brain called dendrites. And they're little very complex protein structures, and they're constantly changing. You're never the same. Every experience changes you. Even memories don't stay quite the same, but memories are thoughts. Thoughts are memories, and they're always changing. And as you get more and more experience, they're always changing. You're always growing. You're always experiencing. You're always going to that next level. And it's as you mature, and it's the rest of your life, you're going to be doing this. So I think it's very important that we understand that that the mind is not the brain, that you actually can change your brain. Yeah, which is really nice. So it's nice to know that if I have this way of thinking, if I'm saying something and I'm doing something, then I've spent time thinking about it. And if I've spent time thinking and I've spent time feeling, if I've spent time feeling, I've spent time choosing. And that thinking and feeling and choosing has built structures in the brain, and those are thoughts. So that's and because of what we call neuroplasticity, neuro means brain and plastic means to change, you can change how your brain functions. So if you recognize that you do doing something and it's causing you discomfort, it's causing people around you discomfort, you can use that feedback to recognize, okay, well, this is a behavior that I have that I can change. And those behaviors are the result of the thoughts. And the thoughts were built as a result of your thinking, feeling, and choosing. And the thoughts that you build contain information. So whatever you are thinking, feeling, and choosing about, so if it's a behavior you're constantly getting bullied at school and that input's coming in and you're going to think and feel and choose about that, and you build up this thought in your brain that I'm not worthy, or I'm scared, or I'm useless, or those whatever it is, because everyone's going to respond in their own unique way, but it's going to be something toxic because it's a toxic experience. So inside that thought tree, this protein thought tree, the physical, the emotional experience, the actual experience is built into a physical structure in the brain. And that physical structure contains the information of that bullying and the emotions of that bullying. So emotions are tied in with information inside the thought trees. And if it's a toxic thought, then it's toxic information and toxic emotions. If it's a healthy thought, then it's healthy information and healthy emotions. So we basically then are expressing those thoughts in the words, in our actions and words and our emotions and so on. So we can look back at those and we can change those. They don't dictate who we are unless we keep them. If we just keep them, then that's how we'll carry on being. But if you're going to change, then you got to look at your behaviors, and you have the power inside of you, because with your mind you built them. With your mind you can change them.
Oh, well, okay. Well, all right. So this is really, I got a ton of questions here, because this is really interesting.
Yeah, far away.
And this, so if I have a toxic thought, right? I have a thought that I'm not adequate. So my growing up, my thought, I was raised by a single mother, didn't have a father. The toxic thought that I wasn't smart enough. We had no money. So that became a toxic thought. I was the victim, toxic thought. This toxic thought in my mind filtered through my brain, which is really the engine that pushes out shares my thoughts, right? So I think it, and then goes through this brain. Does a toxic thought create a toxic brain? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, totally. So as you think and feel and choose, that's your mind, and that's 99% of who you are. So here you have this experience as a child where your mom was single, you didn't have much money, she couldn't really spend much time with you. Yeah. So you've got like a self-image issue, and there's whatever. That's those experiences, and that's energy, those words, the things she said, a lot of them probably unintentional, whatever, but it went inside of you. You processed it. A little boy, you thought, felt, and chose. And as you did that, you changed the structure of your brain. You grew these thoughts into your brain. Now, our brain is not wired or structured characteristically for toxic traumas and irritations and toxic whatever. It's our brain is actually all the wiring, all the chemicals, everything are actually designed in a positive direction, which is quite interesting. So when we experience something negative, the proteins don't fold properly and the chemicals don't work properly and the electrical activity is all weird, but it's still there. So you've got this really ugly looking tree, which is, if you see me on YouTube, I always use this kind of wiry looking tree. Yep. Just to help people have an analogy in their mind of the thought's still there. You've still changed the structure of your brain. You've still changed your brain. You've grown your brain in a direction, but it's toxic and it's causing brain damage. And it increases your vulnerability to low-grade inflammation across your entire body, which means you're vulnerable to get any one of the lifestyle diseases. And if you don't deal with that stuff. And a lot of times, like you as a child, I mean, how do you control that situation? It's your mother's socioeconomic situation was imposing on her ability to be able to, give you the emotional need that you had as a young boy. Yeah. But that's like, we can't even blame her for that, because her circumstances were, yes, sure. We've got to be careful how we handle the situation, because yes, it was difficult that she was in a difficult situation. Yeah. We have to track it right back. Where was the support? If she had the support from a community, then she could have had more emotional support that she could have given you what you needed. So there was this cascading downstream effect of society not supporting the single mom, mm. who then couldn't support her son, who then went into life with a lot of emotional stuff and had to work as an adult to overcome these things. And so we've got to change society as well. We've got to be much more community focused.
I love that. But the thing is, though, like, so for me, My mother is an amazing, one of the most amazing women I've ever met in my entire life. And she's never said, and I've never even heard her say to this, I'm 45 years old to this day. I've never heard her utter a negative word about anybody or any situation. But what happens is, and I would love, this is what I'm really fascinated about is, so I interpret my situation as negative. I interpret these, what's going on. I create a negative story, a toxic story. It filters through my brain. This becomes my personality. This becomes who I am, right? To me, this becomes who I am. And it continues, mm-hmm. It never releases. So that toxicity just stays in my brain. It either stays in my brain or it just grow. And that all of a sudden becomes my personality, becomes my life. Is that the case? Like, is my stories that I'm telling myself?
Yes, pretty much. So whatever you think about the most will grow. So if you going through the situation, and as an adult now, you said some very positive things there. You said your mom's amazing and she's still alive and still amazing. So you explained that as a child, you didn't get quite the nurturing that you needed and affected your early adulthood. But you got to a place in your life where you actually were able to stand back and observe how you were thinking and how your mom, and suddenly you saw, had compassion and you suddenly saw, hey, it was really difficult being a single mom trying to make enough to actually earn a living you shifted, and that compassion shifted how you function. So your brain neuroplastically responded to your mind. So with your mind, you chose to look at what you, instead of blaming your mom, you decided to actually see her circumstances in her whole narrative. And that then helped you to rewire the toxicity of that thought into something positive. But let's say that you didn't. Let's say that you just became so self-involved that you got into drugs and you got into alcohol and you got into self-destructive behaviors, and you just never dealt with the fact that you weren't nurtured like you expected to be, or like a child deserves to be. It's their right to be nurtured. A child is to be nurtured, and you know, and to be able to have someone there pick them up when they fall and hold their hand as they go through the tough stuff. And if you don't get enough of that, it will affect you. But you as once you sort of into adulthood and 18, 19, 20, even earlier, even 15, 16 year olds, you can see with your daughters, you can stand back and say, oh, hang on, let me just see. Dad's got a really high pressure job and maybe I shouldn't be so hard on him. And you did that. But you could have gone the other way. You could have been really sorry. You could have got very bitter and angry, and you could have pursued that and stayed bitter and angry and gone down the wrong road. And that could have played out in innumerable ways. So yes, whatever you choose, whatever you think, feel, and choose about what you've experienced in your life, and that would be called that what you, your early childhood be, as you know, is called adverse child experiences. Yeah. Basically, we call them non-conscious drivers. Whatever you've gone through is driving how you function as an adult. And then that's not, we all know that. But you can just submit to that and make that part of your personality and just say, well, this is me and this is who I am. And so what I've gone through, and just kind of almost be consumed. Or you can stand back and say, this is not how a human operates. Every person, including my mother, my father, whatever, have got a story. And what was their story? And how can I choose to forgive and choose to understand or whatever? And then that changes. So in your personality then shifts back. But it's a choice you make. And every human has that ability to make that choice.
Until what point? At what age do you no longer have that ability to make that choice and to change the toxicity in your brain or to change your outcome or the ideas of what you're feeding your brain where it actually can make a difference? Is there a point where you just like, all right, listen, you're 45 years old and you've had these toxic thoughts and these toxic ideas for 45 years. There's no change in it at this point. Or is it always, are you always able to change?
You're always able to change. Our minds are so powerful that, I mean, my oldest patient was a 78-year-old accountant who wanted to become, I mean, a pilot who wanted to become an accountant. And I mean, that's quite something at 78. He qualified at 84 as an accountant. I have people that are in their 80s and 90s that follow me on social media and that apply these principles and change. It's never, ever, ever too late. Your brain is plastic, literally. And your mind is essentially designed to operate without sounding all super spiritual and stuff, but literally it's designed to operate in a love mode. And we see from quantum physics that our thinking and feeling and choosing generates energy, the kind of energy Einstein spoke about. And at our core level, we can be physical, and then we break down into smaller parts and eventually subatomic particles and eventually waves. And these waves have an energy that they emit that is basically at the core of who we are, is a love energy. And so when we are toxic or get irritated, for example, that wave gets disrupted and it becomes this toxic kind of wave. So we generate this energy from our body and our brain collectively all the time based on what we're actually thinking about. So you can, and it's always changing. So you can generate this toxic energy and you can see it's having a toxic effect on people by your words or actions or whatever. And you can just choose to stay like that. Or you can say, hey, I'm going to self-regulate. I'm going to manage my mind, because we are designed as humans to manage our mind. It's all about mind management. How you manage your mind will determine how you are going to deal with those issues and decide, I'm not going to be like this anymore. I'm going to change. You can do that at any age. There's no time limit on change. You're changing anyway. So if you don't change into the healthy version, that's going to bring you the peace inside of you, which is truly success, when you feel that peace inside of you, then you're going to be you're basically just going to become more toxic. So you're still making a change. So it's just the question is, are you getting more toxic, or are you actually starting to control
the
toxicity?
The whole idea that you control that you control the change, right? You control it. Once you understand that, it's kind of a liberating thought. I'm saying it takes the idea that you have that ability, that God gave you that ability to make this change, right? He didn't program us to be a geese, a goose, exactly, would just fly south, doesn't know why. I'm saying we have that ability of free change, that free will. That's a pretty liberating thing, isn't it?
It's very, very liberating, and it's very important that we teach that to our children, because they're growing up in a society where we pretty much are told that our children are growing up in a society that they're pretty much told that they can't change, that this is, as soon as they battle at school or have any kind of emotional problems, they're hauled off in the system and given a label, and, they're getting locked in. If an adult in your life at a young age tells you something, you know yourself what can happen is you've experienced it yourself. If someone tells you intentionally or unintentionally that you are a broken brain, or you are this, or you are that, you'll live up to that, because you being shaped by your elders, the people around you, they're speaking into your life. So, but that can change at any stage. Anything that has been spoken over to you, that you've been consumed by, all of that can change. And this is the message we have to get to our kids, that your mind is more powerful than your experience, because your experience produced this thought in your, it resulted in a thought in your mind, but your mind can change that. The way that you're behaving in response to the pain you've experienced is not your destiny. It's part of your journey, and we all love to talk about being on a journey, but no one likes doing the hard work of actually, hey, I better go and embrace this. I better process this. I better reconceptualize it, because it's painful, hard, going to get worse before it gets better. It's really difficult. It's so much easier just, that's the label. There's the pill. There's the sort of like magic potion thing, and it doesn't work, and it's not working. And that's why I started off with those statistics, that kind of approach is what's killing people. We will pay the price. Society will pay the price, and society is paying the price. And our children are paying a terribly high price for this model that we have allowed to propagate literally for the last 60 years of labeling them and medicating them.
Listen, I work with corporate companies every day, and I was just with one last week, and they have there's an assessment for everything. There's a personality test here, there's a disc there, there's this. I'm saying,
oh yeah,
10 million of them, right? And so I'm in this company, and outside of their office doors now, they have posted their personality assessment. It says, if you're going to walk into this person, deal with this person this way, right? Everybody has a different one, right? And I'm like, what? Well, this way people know how to deal with them. And I'm thinking, yeah, but people, if you're told enough times you're this, this, and this, well, then all of a sudden they believe they've lost the ability to change. This is who I am. And now that becomes who they are, regardless of whether they want to or not. They start to believe that is their truth. Is that right? I'm saying that's detrimental to the idea of change and evolution, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because we're constantly evolving as a human. So there is a core, you are you, you're not me. I make a lousy you, you make a lousy me. So there's definitely a core of who you are, but the whole IQ movement where you are measured and the personality profile movement where you are categorized, which is what all the DISCUS and these Myers-Briggs and all these things fall into, stick you into a box that you are this type of person. But that's not correct because you aren't a type. You're actually a prototype, if you think of it. You're not a type. You're actually a prototype. So you are your own unique categorical thing. No one's like you. There is no category except yours, and everyone else has their own category. So therefore, the intentions of those profiles are good in that you're trying to recognize that there's a difference between all of us, and don't try and treat everyone the same. That's the good side of it. The bad side is we cannot say that you're a type A person. And I've developed over the years, I developed profiles myself, but they're not personality profiles. I developed them in almost like a rebellion to the profile movement and to the diagnostic movement where I had to measure people. And it's basically a profile, and it's in two of my books because there's two parts to it, where it basically helps people to understand not what kind of personality you have. Forget the personality stuff. That research is, in any case, it's so unscientific, and you'll see a lot of stuff coming out now in the media about the unscientific nature of personality profiles and the whole concept of personality because we change so much. But what is important is to recognize that you have an identity, and your identity is how you uniquely think, feel, and choose, and that how you think, feel, and choose is going to change with all the time through every experience, who you're with, who you marry, who you don't marry, who your friends are, and what you do and where you live and your socioeconomic and the political. And so everything is contributing. Your suffering shapes you, and all these things are all contributing to how your thinking, feeling, and choosing will grow organically. So you think and feel and choose in a unique way, which means you see life in a certain way. And that can obviously become filtered by toxicity, as we've been saying. But there's a core part of you that sees it differently to me. And that's what we need to be focusing on, the fact that you see it differently to me, and it can become very distorted through pain and suffering. But pain and suffering can also be used to grow that organically in a very good direction.
Looking for the ideal on-the-go, super delicious, brain-boosting snack? Then you need to try Super Fat Nut Butters, my favorite go-to snack. Right now, I'm snacking on some apple slices with a super fat protein nut butter spread on top. Delicious. The healthy fats, carbs, and protein really help me stay focused, full, and energized so I can power through hours of podcasting and research. Super Fat Nut Butters are certified keto and paleo. Ready to take your snack game to the next level? Well, Super Fat is offering a special discount just for my listeners. Get 15% off your order when you use the code DRLEAF at checkout. Just go to superfat.com and use the code DRLEAF at checkout. The link will also be in the show notes. Ladies, I need to tell you about a bra company that has changed my life. Third Love. With Third Love, I took a really quick and fun online quiz, which then matched me to the perfect bra, shape, and size. Every customer has 60 days to wear it, wash it, and put it to the test. If you don't love it, you can return or exchange it for free, and Third Love will donate it to a woman in need. Right now, they are offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/drleaf. That's thirdlove.com/drleaf for 15% off today. Let me tell you about my secret weapon for learning new things and getting ahead. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need to know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to.
I love Blinkist because in less than 15 minutes, I feel like I can fast track my path to a more intelligent and informed and healthy me. I use Blinkist as part of my daily brain building morning routine, which helps really boost my mental health throughout the day. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Dr. Leaf. Try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. The link will be in the show notes. So to embrace that pain and suffering and that depression and look for the lessons and let it shape you, not be afraid of it. We mustn't be afraid of feeling, which we've become afraid of. You know, the society today's age doesn't encourage us to feel.
Only because the only reason why we're afraid to feel is because we feel, if I feel sad, if I feel upset, if I feel shame, if I feel, then I'm broken. That's it. I'm saying that it's the fear of what I'm going to be perceived as or what story that's going to create in my head.
Yeah, so your words, exactly. Now listen, look at that. The fear of how we perceive. So we've become so shaped by society and so shaped by what we think is normal that we're scared to be true to ourselves. So we've taken all authenticity away from the human experience. And because we're so busy trying to be the way that the world is shaping us, this is normal, that's normal. But it's not normal because, quite frankly, all of us are what is normal. Yale brought out a study quite recently last year where they show that there is no normal brain. Yet the whole of neuroscience is focused around, and billions of dollars are being poured into finding out what is a normal brain and what's going wrong in the brain that makes you have the illness of being sad or the illness of having seasonal affective disorder, which is just ridiculous, or having bipolar, as though it's some kind of brokenness in your brain. Meanwhile, those are simply a categorical description of a big word, an umbrella term for a whole bunch of stuff. What could make you feel depressed is not going to make, you know, it's different for me, it's different for someone else. And everyone experiences depression and anxiety and gets affected by weather and gets what it's normal, some more than others. And so what we need, once again, as I said in the beginning, is that we need mind management. We need to be learning how to be some more self-regulated. We need to be able to do mental autopsies. We need to be able to recognize the need for connecting with each other in community.
This is really good. I want to move on, but really one of the things, I just want to go back to what you said, and this is how smart you are. You said it almost as a throwaway line, but I wrote it on my whiteboard. I have a whiteboard desk, and I literally wrote it in bold letters. You are not a type. You are a prototype. And really, I'm saying that's really it. I'm saying God didn't create us on an assembly line. He created us in an art studio, right? I'm saying everyone is different, and so that's really really powerful stuff right there. And so I want to kind of shift a little bit because you mentioned it a little bit, and you talked about depression. And you brought up depression, that everybody feels depression at some point. The idea of depression, and maybe there's a thought, you wrote a great blog, I don't know if it was last year I had read it, that talked about depression and the idea that most people immediately, if they say, well, I have depression or I'm depressed, that there's a chemical imbalance, that it's a chemical effect. First, would that be an accurate statement? Is that what it is? If I'm depressed, does that mean that I have a chemical imbalance?
Absolutely not. And it's very good that you brought this up because it's a lot of misinformation. The chemical imbalance myth is actually, that's what it's called by even psychiatrists, even the American Psychiatric Association, and the head of the American Psychiatric Association there's actually a written statement that the chemical imbalance is a myth. It's a great marketing tool that sells drugs. So basically, you've got a chemical imbalance, you need a drug, you need chemicals added to fix your chemical imbalance. And where it was birthed back in the 50s by a scientist who was theorizing that maybe there's, when people feel sad, there's a chemical imbalance in the brain, and that's the cause of the depression. But it was never proven or scientifically shown to be true because it's impossible to show it, because it doesn't exist. You don't have you can't measure for a chemical imbalance. You can't, it's just not, there isn't a chemical imbalance formula that we can find through some sort of test and then say that that's what depression looks like. And they've spent billions of dollars trying to find what they call the neurobiological correlates and the chemical, you know, in terms of the chemistry of the brain and the structure of the brain for things like depression. And they've never found it because it isn't there to be found, because each of us is unique and each of us is not only going to experience depression once or twice in our life. We're going to experience depression, if you're honest with ourselves, it can happen weekly. It can even happen daily. You'll have moments in your day where you may feel very flat. It's quite normal. You'll have moments in periods of your life where you'll have seasons where you feel really awful, where it's really hard to just feel anything maybe. And it's different extremes for everyone. And that's not an illness. That's not a chemical imbalance. Your mind is 99% of who you are. Your mind, as I've been saying, is how you think, feel, and choose. And how you think, feel, and choose is in response to what you're going through. And that thinking, feeling, choosing, mind, and action, 99% energy, you move through your brain. Your brain is physical. If you're dead, your brain does nothing. Your brain is responding, and we can see this. I use technology in my neuroscientific research. We use very advanced brain technology, and we can see the brain responding in real time to how you're thinking and how you're feeling. And so your brain obviously is going to respond, because your mind is moving through your brain. Your body responds. You eat food, your body responds. You get hungry, your body responds. You feel sad, your body responds. So your brain and your body obviously are going to have a reaction to what you are going through, but they are not producing what you're going through. Your mind actually causes it. The research shows absolutely clearly, and this is probably going to change and become an even higher statistic as we understand more, but we can see that up to 95% of illnesses that kill people, lifestyle diseases like the autoimmune and the cancers and the cardiovascular diseases and so on, come from lifestyle diseases. What are the deaths? I mean, people are 95% of disease is lifestyle related, preventable lifestyle. If you ask what lifestyle is, so if 95% of cancers, et cetera, are coming from lifestyle, what is lifestyle? Lifestyle is seven things. Lifestyle is how we manage chronic stressors, which is the day-to-day stuff. What's your mind management for that? What's your mind management for acute stressors? The big things that happen that you are unexpected, that happen frequently, fairly infrequently, but they happen. Your identity, what do you, like we spoke about this already, how the world is shaping us, how we personality profiles, instead of being allowed to be our own unique self, instead of being, we're getting lumped as a category or as a number, but you are type U. You, no one can match you. If your identity is taken, if you get jealous, you lose your humility, there's pride that will come in, there's fighting, there's arguments, you don't understand others. So identity, and that wrecks your brain and body. Not managing your acute stresses and chronic stresses wrecks your brain and your body. If you're not dealing with things that have happened in your past, like you've spoken about stuff in your past and you dealt with it as an adult, you've dealt with that. If you don't deal with those unconscious drivers, it's going to put your body at risk. If you don't watch your diet, if you don't sleep, if you don't exercise, those seven factors are lifestyle factors. If they're not managed by you with your mind, with your thinking, feeling, and choosing, you step into that low-grade inflammation across your entire brain and body, which then makes you vulnerable to these lifestyle diseases, which then can shorten your life. If you take that and just treat the physical, and you've got to treat the physical, I don't deny that. If you develop type 2 diabetes because you aren't eating properly, and you're not eating properly because you're depressed, and you're depressed because you've never dealt with your childhood issues, can you see the tracking back? If I don't deal with all of that, yes, you're going to land up with major maybe fatty liver disease or something, and you're going to have to treat that because it's the physical result of. You're going to land up, but you still have to find out the cause. Why do you have the fatty liver disease? What is your diet? Why aren't you exercising? Why aren't you sleeping? I mean, you don't sleep, you set yourself up for cardiovascular disease. You're not sleeping because your thoughts are chaotic. Why are your thoughts chaotic? Because you're not managing your chronic stress. So the whole thing tracks back very neatly to how we are managing our mind. And that means that we as a society have to teach our children, teach each other, help each other. You cannot do this alone. We're not designed to do life alone. We're designed to do life in community. And we need to be helping each other to manage your stuff, to sit and hold hands. And like I said about your teenagers, if your teenager is going through something, you know, you can't fix it for them. It's the worst thing you can do is fix it for them. You want to fix it for them, but the best thing you can do is put the tightrope there, which is sit down next to them and say, this is a lot to manage, but I'm here with you. We'll do this together. You know, that's the sort of thing that's going to be able to build that resilience in a person and help them to be able to move through life more effectively.
So is it safe to say that then if I'm following this correctly, I have the thought in my mind, I have this negative thought, this depressed thought, this sad thought, this whatever, that I have this thought in my mind. It cycles through my brain and then manifests itself in my body, in the body. And now not dealt with, it'll take on even more and will literally make me sick. So what started in my mind is actually going to manifest itself out, and then not dealt with correctly, not managed correctly, not released correctly through love or friendship or community or these things, then it's going to have a physical effect on me. It could physically cause me to be sick. It could physically, which only makes me think that I have some sort of chemical imbalance or something's wrong with me, as opposed to dealing with it in a better way.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens. So the mind leads to the physical, and the physical becomes a warning signal that something's going on. And it's going to be different for everyone. Someone might get cardiovascular issues. Someone might get cancer. Someone might get this. Now, I'm not saying that if you think badly, you're going to get sick, but there's a 95% chance that if you don't manage your thinking, you will get sick. I mean, those are just the facts. Those are what we're seeing, and it's all preventable. And then if you get guilt and shame, that'll keep you even more stuck. So you need to guilt, shame, condemnation, labeling, drugs, whatever, none of those are going to cure the facts, cure what's going on. And obviously, if your body's now feeling awful because you've pushed this weird sort of toxic wave of energy through your brain, it's upset your blood chemistry, it's upset your the energies that's required to drive the genomes, the correct genomic effect, which means that the genetics have to switch on correctly and produce the right substances that you need for cell survival. If that's not happening, your body starts breaking down. So there's a response in your body that has to be addressed. So absolutely, you may find that your serotonin levels do drop off and your dopamine levels do drop off and that you have an increase in homocysteine. And yes, we will see physical effects, but it's not a chemical imbalance that is now an illness. You have an illness of chemical imbalance. And therefore, if I give you some chemicals, I can fix you and you're going to be all fine. Right. That's the philosophy. Yeah. It hasn't worked. That's what's killing people. What it is that, okay, there is a result in your body. And what we need to do is deal with the symptoms, not through an antidepressant. That's not going to help. We're going to have to deal with the physical effects. So if there is cardiovascular issues, we need to now deal with the physical effect. We need to deal with the cardiovascular issue in whichever way. But we at the same time can't only address that, because there's a feedback system, because now you're broken or feeling awful, your heart, whatever, that can increase feelings of depression. You have a gut-brain axis. You've got this link between the brain and the gut, and what you're eating and what you affects your gut, again, affects your brain and vice versa. So if you're, that goes for your heart, every system of your body, every cell of your body, if you're feeling awful, it's really hard to feel happy. So you've got this feedback loop. So we have to address the physical, get the physical under control, but we've got to stop saying that you have clinical bipolar depression because you have a chemical imbalance. Yeah. That's not even science. It doesn't tell anyone anything, and it doesn't help anyone with anything. It just makes things worse. What we need to say is you're feeling depressed. Okay, that's a reality. You're feeling you're actually having physical heart problems, or you've got tremendous digestive issues. Let's treat the digestive issues. Let's change your diet, your exercise. Let's look at what's going on in your blood. Let's check out all those. Let's do all this physical stuff because we have to address it. Yeah. Let's fix it, change diet, etc. But at the same time, let's look at why you're depressed. What's going on in your life? What's your story? And then, so I developed over the years, 30 years of research, and 25 years of clinical practice, I've had a lot of experience. I developed techniques studying how the mind-brain connection works and brain research, and developed techniques to help people to stand back, observe their own thinking, become aware of what are these physical and emotional warning signals in my life and what does it mean? And it's based on science and it's a five-step process, and that five-step process is used to detox the brain, whether it's of a toxic habit or some kind of abuse or trauma that you've been through. And also in that process of addressing that, you're not just going to try and change. It's not cognitive behavior therapy. It's not psychotherapy. It is you learning to manage your mind and self-regulate your mind. It's a process that teaches you, okay, this is how I'm feeling. Let me now address this. What is the cause? And you go through a process that is how your brain actually builds memory. And you find the toxic issue and you break that toxic issue down and you rebuild it. So you embrace, you process, and you redesign. Yeah. You don't try and eliminate because it's part of your story.
Yeah.
But you turn it around, you reconceptualize it to the point where it doesn't control you, you control that. And we've put all this in, yeah. I've got books and things, which I'm sure we'll mention at the end, but we've put this into an app called Switch, which is fairly new, and we've just about to upgrade it now this week into its new format. And it's amazing because it's all these techniques that I've put into a very simple technology platform. And the last thing I wanted to say about I've always got a lot to say, but basically that relates to this whole concept is the fact that you can't do this alone. And I've stressed this a few times, you know, sit with your teenager, sit with your friend, sit with whoever, listen to each other, ask for the help. Connect with each other. Don't try and fix someone, but support someone. Very big difference between those. We can't do this alone. We build resilience by helping each other.
I think, I definitely want to talk about Switch, and we're running out of time, so I have a couple more questions. But the entire idea that, listen, we're into a new year. By the time this broadcast, this will be in the new year, new decade. And most people are going to have this New Year's resolution. They're going to change they're going to ignore the things that happened in the past, and they're going to forge ahead to make a better life. But the reality is, until you deal with these systematic thoughts that you've been avoiding forever, that have been negative, until you find the root cause and the root toxicity of that, at some point it's going to start growing again. It's almost like a weed. You have to deal with it. You have to eliminate it and then move on. Is that correct?
Exactly. You have to deal with it, and you're dealing with it by embracing it, literally celebrating it, which sounds really weird, but you're celebrating the fact that you're weakening it. Because as soon as you're consciously aware of something, you can change it. If you're not consciously aware of something, you can't. So yes, you are embracing, you're processing, and you're reconceptualizing. And reconceptualizing means that you're redesigning it. It's like, you remember, I used to get like this, and then I was like that, and I did this. So maybe with your life, you used to be maybe, I don't know, I'm just guessing, but from a little that you've said, it affected your self-esteem a little bit, this whole thing growing up. And so you can basically reconceptualize it. Now going through seeing, oh, well, my mom didn't intentionally make me feel bad or try and destroy my self-esteem. She herself was battling. And your compassion and your choice to stand back and observe your own thinking, that helped you see it from a different angle, reconceptualize. So you built a healthy thought. So you started off the program telling me about your life. It shows me that you've and how you've changed.
Oh, yeah.
So you've reconceptualized. So you still remember your suffering, but it's made you a better person. And that's what I mean. We've got to do that. We've got to embrace and process and reconceptualize.
You know, if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at will change. And basically what I'm doing is I'm looking at it through a different lens and saying, well, without that, I'm not the person I am today. I'm not doing this podcast today. I've changed it. It served an important role in my growth. I've learned how to deal with it. I've addressed it. Now this is how I view that past. I view it completely differently, which changes how it filters through my brain, which changes my body's reaction to it. Now it doesn't make me weak and feel less than. It makes me strong and feel powerful. Would that be right? Yeah.
Exactly. Totally powerful in a very positive sense, because what I always tell like people to realize is that when you start operating in this very self-regulated lifestyle, because essentially mind management, which is pretty much the big word, the main word for what I teach, is telling people how to manage their minds in terms of everything, in terms of dealing with stuff and relationships and everything, is when you do that, you start shifting how your body functions and you set up this really wonderful feedback loop between mind, brain, and body that enables you to basically function at a different level. That it's a continual process, not going to be overnight. It's a continual process.
All right. So a couple more questions. So one, where do people find you? I know, and I'm going to say this before you do, but you have the most amazing website. Like, I don't know who created the website, but if you want something and you want to know something, I'm saying you can go to our website and there's, oh my gosh, there's clinical studies you're working on now. There's books. I'm saying everything is on your website. So, but with your website, and then where else do people find you?
Thank you. DrLeaf.com. I assume you put it in the show notes. Also, they can my podcast. I have a podcast called Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. We have if people join the newsletter, they're going to get a weekly blog. But I've also got blogs like normal. We all have blogs, podcasts, and then we have there's the store on the website that's got lots of information. So, and then if people want to know about my clinical trials that I'm doing, I mean, we had just to tell you, we're talking about depression. We're busy analyzing it now, and we've had people come into the study that have been so depressed and lethargic and not being able to sleep and process information just by using that switch app that I was talking about, which are the five steps that I've developed over the techniques that I've developed over these 30 years that we've now put in this technological platform and app on your phone. Just using that, they didn't have any interaction with me. They used my app. So it was through technology. They went through this process, learned to mind manage, did the five steps. And by day 21, within 3 weeks, they had the depression, the lethargy, the lack of sleep, the inability to process information and not be able to contact, gone. By day 63, which is 9 weeks later, it was sustained. And total changes in their blood, total changes. So as these narrative, as the mind management changed, their narrative changed, their lifestyle changed, the blood changed, the chemistry, blood chemistry changed, the physical changed, the brain changed. And it's being sustained. These people are now, we've just tested 3 months later again, and we're getting the results in from that. It's people are sustaining a pattern. So once you self-regulate, you change. And the results, the evidence is there. So that's a doctor. If people want to know more about that, it's DrLeafResearch.com.
The app.
They can see about the studies, okay. the clinical
app
trials.
Is phenomenal. I'm saying the idea that you have, we use, there's a lot of conceptions, a lot of thoughts about social media and technology. But here's really the benefit of technology. And that is when I have done, used the right way, it is powerful. I'm saying it is powerful that somebody can have an app that really is. I'm saying there's a million apps out there, but really that has clinical backing, that has tips of the day, it has resources, it has a journal that you can write in. I'm saying really right at the fingertips, you have this computer at your fingertips all day to help you kind of detox you and get to the life you actually were designed to have. Not this life that you designed in a negative state, but the one that you were actually created for.
Exactly.
If you haven't read any of her books, which she's got a million amazing ones, make sure you grab them. I really like your latest one, Switch on Your Brain. But there's another great one, which we didn't really talk a lot about. Maybe that's for another time. But the whole connection between what you eat and how you think. And you have a great book called Think and Eat Yourself Smart, which is phenomenal, phenomenal book. One of your other amazing books. All right, last question. So thank you very much. I know your time is unbelievably valuable, so I'm going to end it right on time. My last question for you, and that is, when you leave this earth many, many, many years from now, what do you want your contribution to have been?
Probably my biggest contribution is to help people to realize that they can think, that they have this ability to direct their brain, this directed neuroplasticity, this ability to mind manage. And if you teach people to think, they change. And, it's to teach them to really stand back and observe their own thinking. And I often say to people, and this may summarize it all, is that you can't control the events and circumstances of your life, but you can control your reactions. So that's your thinking. You can control your thinking. And when we do control our thinking, things change.
Mm. Fantastic. Fantastic. Listen, it was an hour. It felt like 5 minutes. So I don't know, I could have done this for another 23 hours straight.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet of you. Thank
really
you.
Really appreciate you. And I know the last thing is you have this great conference once a year. I think it's in December. You probably just finished it, right?
Yes, the Mental Health Summit. We just had it last weekend, and it's open for pre-registration now. We filled up by in October last year already. We had to close registrations early. Wow. So we're very excited. We're going to be doubling the numbers space now. We'll have a lot more, double the numbers. So we'll have up to 2,500 space for 2,500 people. But it's already starting to fill up. So people are, and it's great. We handle all these things in a lot of depth, and it's really great. And we're also doing a mental health challenge soon. So it'll be with the Switch app, and they can find out those details on our website as well, which is going to be very exciting. We're going to set up a whole community and do it together.
Awesome. I love it. All right. So get her book, get the app right away. Get the app right away. Share the app too with people that need it, because I think everybody needs that help in their pocket. And then attend that conference and make sure you subscribe to her podcast. A great million podcasts out there. I don't know of one. I'm a big podcast guy that is as tactical and practical as this one. Remember, you're not a type, you're a prototype. So thank you very much, Dr. Caroline Leaf. I really appreciate
you. My pleasure. Time.
I hope you found today's podcast interesting and helpful. If you want more tips and help with managing anxiety, depression, and mental health, be sure to visit my website at drleaf.com. And to sign up for my weekly newsletter, where I also include a schedule of my speaking events and so much more. And follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just look for Dr. Caroline Leaf. Also, I love seeing all your posts on social media about this podcast. I love seeing what resonates with you and what you've learned. So be sure to continue posting and tagging me and letting me know what you think and how these tips worked out for you. And don't forget, leave a review and keep spreading the word about this podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I really hope you learned something new and helpful. Till then, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf. This podcast represents the opinions of myself and my guests. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. The content here is for educational and informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional for any individual medical questions you may have. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors.